We have all technical things worked out. Okay. Welcome, everyone. This is the International Peace Coalition. This is our 68th meeting. My name is Anastasia Battle, and I'll be your moderator today. I'll be joined with Dennis Small and Dennis Speed as well. We have a pretty decent lineup for you within our agenda, which I'm posting in the chat for our Zoom participants at the moment. We are co-streaming this across many different platforms. Please, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, you will need to register and get onto the Zoom if you'd like to participate during the discussion period. The reason why we created this forum for true peace is to bring people of many different ideologies together who actually want to stop thermonuclear war, who want to prevent the killing of people all over the planet, and to bring these many different organizations together, despite our ideological differences, through our many different cultural aspects of our nations and language cultures, in order to accomplish that. So we've had a very successful run so far of 68 weeks. Hopefully we don't get shut down. This is a very important dialogue. Last week we had 1,000 participants, which is a very wonderful jump. So thank you again, all of you, for joining us in this dialogue process. I will open it up to Dennis Small, who is of the Schiller Institute, and he is one of my IPC moderators to go through the discussion period, or excuse me, to go through the opening period right now. Please go ahead, Dennis Small.
Okay, thank you very much, Anastasia, and thank you everyone for participating in this discussion. I would like to begin by noting that it's a distinct possibility that at the time of the next 69th meeting of the International Peace Coalition, a week from today, it's indeed possible that long-range precision-guided missiles could already be flying from Ukrainian territory, NATO missiles from Ukrainian territory in the direction of Russia. This is a very distinct possibility. There was a meeting last week at the White House between the British Prime Minister Starmer and President Joe Biden, sometimes known as Collective Biden, in which this topic was discussed, where the agreement beforehand between the United States and the UK was that they did want to move in the direction of using those NATO missiles, but that it had to be further organized, pushed internationally, and that they expected to have some announcements in the course of the upcoming UNGA, United Nations General Assembly meeting next week. In particular, there is scheduled to be a meeting on Thursday, September 26th, between President Biden and Zelensky of Ukraine, where Zelensky is scheduled to present his victory plan, quote unquote, which includes emphatically the use of long-range precision-guided missiles shot from Ukrainian territory deep into Russian territory. And I want to emphasize, just for starters, and this really is one of four major points that I want to address in my brief opening remarks, that what we are talking about here in terms of the danger of war, the aspect of the long range of the missiles has, which is important, has often been emphasized while not taking account of the fact that the precision guidance is perhaps the most significant feature. That is to say, these things cannot fly past, through, around, under, and over Russian air defense systems without real-time, highly sophisticated guidance available only through United States and other NATO assets, in particular American satellites. And therefore, when you're talking about quote unquote permitting the Ukrainians to shoot these things off, you're talking about this being the decisions being made on the guidance and on the missions themselves, not in Ukraine, but in London and Washington. The Russians are very well aware of this. They have said this Repeatedly, President Putin has said it over the course of this week. There have been repeated statements to that effect coming from, among others, the head of the Duma, Vyacheslav Volodin, making it quite clear that if this happens, we are talking about entering the domain of nuclear warfare. Now, over the course of the last few days, as the drums have begun to roll and move in the direction of this kind of a process, you can see the preparations in various ways for this. Number one, the attack on the Toropets depot in Russia. Whatever the actual military significance of this, and I know there are a lot of different versions of this floating around, and we don't know the military facts, but the actual intent was to create the kind of incident which could be used to build up the idea that this is going to have to keep going on and go on far more seriously, deeper into territory and so on. Also, the aspect of checking out what the Russian air defense system is, profiling that and preparing for what comes. That's one very important development. A second very important development is the rapid escalation of the war on the Lebanon front, Israel's attack on Lebanon. It's part of the same global battle. We can get into this further in the rest of the discussion, but the same people behind those who are trying to provoke Russia or provoke a war between NATO and Russia using Ukraine are the same people who are using Israel to try to expand the war there and to get Iran involved and others. And then from that standpoint, Russia as well. This act of blatant terrorism, which occurred with the pagers and handheld radios and so on, is simply an opening salvo of that escalation against Hezbollah and into Lebanon. A third point on this, which I'd like to mention, is a statement issued by the Europarliament I believe it was yesterday, in which they called for all member states to lift all limitations on the weapons which Ukraine is allowed to use. It's a very strong statement. It is explicit in saying as well that Germany must allow the Taurus missiles to be used, which is something that Chancellor Scholz has said repeatedly, which is quite amazing for someone who has as little demonstrated courage as he. No, 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 we don't want to use the Taurus missiles. The Europarliament called for that. It may well be the case that the Europarliament does not have decision-making power. However, the Russians know exactly what this means and have responded to this. Volodin, again, who is the head of the Duma, personally very close to Putin, and furthermore is on the National Security Council of Russia, responded to the Europarliament vote by saying that what they are doing opens the way to a nuclear world war. Moscow has more powerful weapons. No one should have any illusions about this. The State Duma insists on this. Now, the timing around this and the insistence in the direction has everything to do with two related developments. One is what's going on around the United States elections, and the second is what's happening in the global majority, in particular, the buildup to the BRICS. As for the election side of this, let me just quote what Jake Sullivan had to say earlier this week. This was in a message that he delivered by video link to a conference in Kiev, the Yalta European Strategy Conference. And the discussion was how much help can and will the United States give to Ukraine, the particular question being these long-range precision-guided missiles. And Sullivan said that they understand that there are only 4 months left before a new U.S. president is sworn in. We are going to treat each single one of those days preciously when it comes to supporting Ukraine. He said, I believe that we are at a vital moment at a crossroads. And that's true. We are at a vital moment. We are at a crossroads. And you might want to take into consideration as you're planning out what you're going to be doing next week, what I said at the outset, which is that a week from today, we may be in that stage of the hot war unless we act and mobilize to make sure that this does not occur. The second point that I wanted to make is that there is a wartime censorship process spreading across the planet that would make Goebbels jealous. This is part of the war mobilization. It is not separate from it. And it is targeted especially to those areas where there could be some opposition to these policies, and where those who do oppose it are being silenced. The objective is to silence them. There are various ways to silence people. One way is to eliminate them. And I believe that the two attempted assassinations on President Trump have to be viewed in exactly that fashion for a reason I'll explain in a moment. This is not a question of electoral politics. This is a question of nuclear war. Both hits within a period of 2 months point in a certain direction. Both show strong indications of security stripping. And that's a very serious question as to the functioning of the Secret Service. And this last one, Mr. Ruth, who is the accused attempted assassin, traces directly to networks in Ukraine and through Ukraine into London of the Azov Battalion, of the CCD, the Centers for Countering Disinformation, and people who have stated their policy that they will silence, or their word is terminate, anybody who is opposed to the Ukrainian, i.e. the Western narrative, and anyone who thinks that war is a bad idea. Many of you people on this call have been put on that CCD list. Helga Zeplerush and the Schiller Institute is right up at the top of it. The next speaker in today's program, Scott Ritter, is one of the prominent people on that CCD list. And there is a definite CCD link into this second attempted assassination through Mr. Ruth. It should also be noted that the CCD is directly implicated. CCD, Murat Varetz, Molfar, it's all the same State Department financed, British financed hit list operation, whose stated purpose is that anyone who opposed their views is an information terrorist who must be silenced and terminated. But their involvement is also evident around the Fico attempted assassination in Slovakia a number of months ago, and new developments around President Lukashenko in Belarus in the same direction. As part of this silence any opposition, part of the war mobilization, we have to look at the blatant censorship operation underway a week ago on Friday the 13th. The State Department announced the new directives as part of the existing executive order, sanctioning not only RT and Sputnik and a bunch of other Russian media, but pretty much anybody who has pretty much any connection with them. If you've read the fine print, as we have, it is completely a blank check for McCarthyite and beyond type of censorship operations. You know, there's this old saying that in the world of legal cases, that you can get a jury to indict a ham sandwich. In this case, you have a situation where, with these new regulations, you can actually convict a nothing burger. And that is what they're in the process of doing. This is part of the war mobilization. And along with this goes direct moves by the British with the CCD to spread their capabilities to be able to silence people. Concretely, on September 17th, Ian Paterson, who is the deputy director of the Russia desk at the Foreign Office, traveled to Kiev, where he met with the head of the CCD, Andrei Kovalenko, and what they mapped out were joint efforts to silence any voices anywhere who oppose NATO's war against Russia. They said that they had agreed to intensify coordination, and this was a spin-off of the previous week's close UK-US strategic dialogue in London. And that special relationship between the British and the United States is behind the expansion of the wars on various fronts, including the Southwest Asia situation. Now, the third point that I wanted to make is that what is going on in the US presidential election process now is new. The issue of nuclear war, thanks to many of you on this call and the work that we've done, as well as the gravity of the situation, has in fact broken out into the campaign process. This is not a partisan question. Trump, three times in the last week, has mentioned the danger of nuclear war. Whatever you think about Trump, he's mentioning the danger of nuclear war. Seriously, this was first at the debate with Kamala Harris, then was at a rally at in Las Vegas, and then in Flint, Michigan. At that Las Vegas rally, Tulsi Gabbard spoke, and she was eloquent on the question of nuclear war. Bobby Kennedy has spoken out on the question of nuclear war. Dennis Kucinich, who is a Democrat, he's running as an independent now, but he was a Democratic congressman from Ohio. He has spoken on the IPC platform. He came out with a very strong statement on nuclear war. So although there are many efforts afoot to try to make sure this does not break out into the public, this is absolutely out there and very important to our efforts to stop it. And my fourth and final point has everything to do with stopping this as well, and that is the extraordinary development at the UNGA this week with the vote on the Palestine question, which was an overwhelming vote for sanity, an overwhelming vote for humanity in the face of one of the worst genocides in our lives, my life in any event, we've witnessed. And this was a vote of 124 to 14 with 43 abstentions. The Economist, I just saw a headline this morning, said, a UN vote on Palestine underlines America's weakening clout. And that is, in fact, the case. It is the first direct presentation of the Palestinian ambassador, the representative there, of a resolution. The ICJ findings were part of that resolution. And this demonstrates that, in fact, the global majority has had it. It's just a microcosm of the fact that the global majority has had it with this bankrupt, collapsing system, and it is in revolt. Indicative of the same, India quickly declared that they would have nothing to do with the State Department sanctions on RT. They're not interested. Member of the BRICS, big country. Brazil, President Lula responded to Zelensky saying, no, we're not going to back you in this war on the Ukraine war question with Russia, just as Brazil would not back the war on Iraq at the time because we knew it was a phony operation and we're not going to be part of this. So with the BRICS meeting coming up, October 22nd to 24th, that is a vehicle of expression of opposition to this entire paradigm, which is leading us to war. We have the developments in the U.S. presidential campaign, which open doors and possibilities. And the last point I want to mention is the financial system, the crashing financial system, which is what is behind the war drive in the first place, is in very, very bad shape. The rise in interest rates of the Federal Reserve this week by 50 basis points is not a sign of strength. It is a sign of tremendous weakness of that system. They are desperately trying to pump liquidity into a $2 quadrillion derivatives bubble, and it's not going to work. It's going to lead to further massive flows back and forth in one direction and the other, as with a carry trade and reverse carry trade, in a situation where there is no way of keeping that financial system afloat. All of this simply puts on the agenda our fundamental issue, which is we must have a new security and development architecture to pull us back from the brink of war and to return to humanity the right to development and security for all people everywhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Okay, I know, Scott, you have limited time, so it's my honor to have you on, a former UN weapons inspector. Thank you so much for joining us, Scott Ritter. Please go ahead.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you, Dennis Small, for your outstanding presentation. In fact, I should probably just yield the floor back to you because you were hitting everything perfectly. We are, you know, I've been accused a lot lately of being an alarmist. Some people say, well, you're irresponsibly engendering fear. But I will say right now that if you are not scared to death, then you're the problem. I'm not the problem. If nuclear war and the prospects of nuclear war don't scare you, I don't know why you're here in this forum, and I don't know what you're trying to accomplish. There literally is no other issue today. No other issue today. I'm going to just emphasize that again because I know people out there feel strongly about very many other issues. There's no other issue today that's more important than preventing a nuclear war, and we almost had one last week. I don't know how, if people don't understand, Keir Starmer brought with him the documents, the target list. If Joe Biden had signed off on those documents, the target list, part of that target list, would have been executed that night. British technicians are already in Ukraine loading target data onto the Storm Shadow missiles. These missiles right now are being used against targets in Novorossiya, in the former Ukrainian provinces of Lugansk, Kherson, Donetsk, and Zaporizhia. Why? Because Ukraine, and again, it's right to say, they say this is our territory. Okay. Crimea, they say it's our territory. Okay. That's why Russia is not responding by threatening nuclear war when Storm Shadow missiles are used against those targets. This is a debatable point. Russian territory, however, outside of those five named areas, is Russian territory. It's sovereign territory, unquestionably sovereign territory. And any effort to use NATO-provided weapons, and it's not just NATO-provided weapons, it's NATO-targeted weapons. As Dennis said, this isn't about just saying, okay, we'll fire a Storm Shadow off. What's the difference between that and any other weapon system Ukraine has? Ukraine has had very good success using long-range drone systems and striking targets deep inside Russia. What's the difference between a Ukrainian drone system and a British or American-provided missile? The Ukrainian drone system is a Ukrainian weapon system directed by the Ukrainian government, and Russia will hold the Ukrainian government to account using whatever means it chooses to do so. This is the nature of conflict between two nations, and Russia and Ukraine are in a state of advanced conflict. Ukraine thinks of it as a war. Russia calls it a special military operation. That's a matter of semantics. They are in conflict with one another. NATO claims not to be a party to this conflict. And yet, when NATO provides weapon systems that can only strike targets when the targets have been processed by NATO-only entities, that's what people need to understand here. It's not just a matter of programming a Storm Shadow missile. There is an element in Europe, part of NATO, that absorbs American intelligence information, overlays it with American mapping information, and turns it into the data necessary to strike a target. That data is loaded into the Storm Shadow. Because the Storm Shadow communicates with GPS, it doesn't do it on a commercial GPS signal. That's just one ch that's just a single channel. It can be jammed. It does it using the military channels. That's two channels. They're encrypted. They're encrypted by the United States using American encryption technology that has to be loaded into the systems by Americans, not by Ukrainians. Ukrainians are not cleared to operate this level of cryptographic keying material. So when a Storm Shadow is fired against a target inside Russia, it is literally being targeted by NATO. NATO is approving of the target and facilitating the use of this weapon system against the target. That means that NATO is a literal party to the conflict. And yet Keir Starmer wanted Joe Biden to sign off on this, to say, allow us to use this American intelligence so that we can strike targets inside Ukraine using the Storm Shadow missile. This is an act of war. And it's something that, had Keir Starmer signed off on, would have been implemented that night. It's not something that's going to happen down the road. It would have happened that night, Friday the 13th. And on Saturday the 14th, we would all have been dead. That's the point I'm trying to make here, people. It's not a joke. It's not a game. The Russians are not bluffing. Vladimir Putin made this clear on Thursday when it became evident that the United States was having this meeting with Starmer in the White House. And he basically said that if you do this, you will be a party to the conflict and Russia will have to act accordingly. Dmitry Peskov, the spokesperson, reiterated this point and said the president has made this quite clear, but not clear enough because they still had the meeting. On Friday, the UN ambassador or the Russian ambassador to the United Nations, in front of the Security Council in session, reiterated this point that it will be a declaration of war if the United States and Great Britain enable Ukraine to use NATO-provided weapons to strike Russia. The Russian ambassador to the United States took it a step further. Anatoly Antonov said, if you think that a nuclear conflict will be limited to Europe, basically acknowledging that if this happens, Russia will use nuclear weapons against Europe. If you're an American and you think it will be limited to Europe, think again. We will strike you. You're playing with fire. Don't let your fingers get burned. Now, when he said this, it sent shockwaves through the American community. Former government officials, and if you know anything about how the establishment works, we have a whole host of former government officials who advise, who are in connect have connectivity with the current administration. They called Anatoly Antonov, and you have to ask yourself, why didn't the government call? Because we don't have connectivity with the Russians anymore. I was at the Russian embassy on Friday night. I was there at the invitation of Anatoly Antonov. I was there to attend a concert, a performance, a piano concert performance of Rimsky-Korsakov and other Russian composers as part of Anatoly Antonov's effort to demonstrate to the American people the culture of Russia to help disentangle, detangle the Russophobia that has spun its web around the Americans. I've never seen the ambassador so distracted and so concerned. This was his big moment. He has been working for months to bring this concert in, to make this demonstration. And yet, at this moment, his mind was elsewhere. And now I know where his mind was. He was uncertain whether or not he would live the day. He was uncertain what the United States would do. He had done his duty in articulating this, though, to the various former government administration who called the Biden administration and said, he's not bluffing. This is as real as it gets. If you sign this document, we will be at war with Russia, and the war will be a nuclear war. I don't know if you guys are hearing what I'm saying. We all almost died on Saturday. If you read Annie Jacobson's wonderful book, Nuclear War, A Scenario, it's a work of fiction, but it was written after consulting with former nuclear war planners, people who were in the system, who understood how nuclear war is fought. They understand how things are going. You know how long it takes for the world to end in a nuclear conflict? From start to finish, from the beginning of the initiation of events that lead to the first launch of a nuclear weapon until all life on Earth is forever destroyed, either instantly or things have been set in motion for the long lingering death. 72 minutes. That's all it takes, ladies and gentlemen. 72 minutes. What are we going to do about this? This is the existential question of our time. What are we going to do about this? I think most people that are in attendance here share my fear, my concerns about the danger of nuclear war. But Joe Biden's not done. As Dennis Small said, he is going to meet with Zelensky at the United Nations General Assembly debate, where they're going to talk about how to make this happen, what is needed to make this happen. The European Parliament, as Dennis said, we want this to happen. Why? Because Europe believes that Russia is bluffing. Europe believes that Putin is bluffing. Europe doesn't believe that Russia would pull the trigger. I've been studying Russia my entire life, first as the Soviet Union, later in the decade of the 90s, and I've been watching Vladimir Putin very closely for 25 years. I've had the privilege of visiting Russia twice in the last year. I would have gone a third time, but the U.S. government stopped it. One of the reasons why they stopped it is because of the insights that I have gained by visiting Russia and speaking with Russians, Russian officials, Russian military officers, etc. I will say this: Russia doesn't bluff. Russia understands what war is more than anybody in the West does. Russia understands the sacrifices necessary to sustain a nation in times of existential crisis. And the Russians are not willing to allow NATO, the United States, or any of its proxies to put the Russian state at risk, to put the Russian nation at risk. And allowing Ukraine to use long-range NATO-provided systems targeted by NATO isn't just an extension of the Ukrainian warfighting capability. It gives NATO a preemptive strike capability. This is what people don't understand. Because if NATO can use Ukrainian weapons to take out strategic targets inside Russia, and then follow that up with a NATO strike, conventional in nature, designed to decapitate Russian leadership, and then follow that up with a wave of low-yield nuclear weapons, which are now integrated into the American arsenal and a part of our nuclear deployment plan, I don't know how many people understand that the former commander of United States Strategic Command, in speaking to Congress, said, "I prefer preemptive nuclear strike." Listen to what I'm saying. I prefer preemptive nuclear strike. That's his preferred way of doing war, preemptive nuclear strike. And now you're a Russian listening to that, and you're watching NATO and the United States give Ukraine the ability to launch the first wave of preemptive action under the guise that it's just Ukraine, paralyzing the Russians so that the second wave, a NATO wave, comes in, decapitates, followed by a preemptive nuclear strike. And you're the Russians saying, "What do we do about this?" And what they do is they say, "We have to draw a line." And the line has been drawn. They are not bluffing. This is existential in nature. We have an election coming up in the United States. It's turning out to be one of the most important elections of our time, not because of abortion, not because of immigration, not because of the economy, not because of anything that everybody else is talking about, but because if we make it to the election, because there's a good chance we won't. There's a good chance we won't make it to next week. There's a good chance we won't make it to tomorrow, depending on decisions that are being made. But if we make it to the election, the person we elect is going to be the person that is either going to take us into World War III, a general nuclear strike, or is going to resolve the issue. Right now, there's only one candidate that's injecting the threat of nuclear war into the political debate, and that, of course, is Donald Trump. There's a lot of people out there that say they could never vote for Donald Trump. That's your prerogative. But if you don't want to vote for Donald Trump, at least exploit the fact that he's injected something into the political debate and make your candidate of choice respond. We have to inject a discussion about the dangers of nuclear war into the American political debate at this election. It must become the existential issue of this election. No other issue matters, because if there is a nuclear war and we're all dead, no other issue matters. We can't solve the issues of abortion, immigration, the economy, and other things else if there is no country, if there is no world. We have to stop this nuclear war. We all almost died last week. And again, I just want to make that point. If it weren't for some brave statements made by Russian government officials, from the president to the two ambassadors, Biden would have signed off on Keir Starmer's documents. Storm Shadow missiles would have been launched against targets inside Russia, and Russia would have responded, beginning the cycle of escalation that leads to a general nuclear conflict. We need to inject sanity into the political discourse. We need to put pressure on Jill Stein to respond to the op-ed that was written by RFK Jr. and Donald Trump Jr. and published in The Hill magazine, which put on the table for the first time from a campaign the necessity of negotiating into the conflict of Ukraine and linking the conflict in Ukraine to the danger of nuclear war, because they are linked. We need Jill Stein to commit. We need Kamala Harris to commit. We need this to become a political issue. And once it becomes a political issue, that puts pressure on the Biden administration not to engage in any precipitous activity that would generate a nuclear conflict. On 28 September, we're having a rally in Kingston, New York. It's the beginning of what I call Operation Dawn. Operation Dawn are just four simple questions I ask the American people. What will you be willing to do to save democracy, to save America, to save the world by making your vote count in November? And what you need to do is just that. Make your vote count. Don't give your vote away. Make a candidate earn your vote. And the issue that you need to emphasize for them to earn is what is their strategy for preventing a nuclear war? What is their strategy for bringing about peace with Russia? What is their strategy for promulgating disarmament, reintroducing disarmament into the political dialogue between Russia and the United States? Right now, only one side has put something out there. We need all sides to do. We need this to become a matter of national discussion, national debate. And then and only then might we dodge this bullet. Thank you very much for letting me speak.
Thank you, Scott. And just for everybody here on the Zoom, I included the link to OccupyPeace.com, the Freedom Rally, where you're going to be having the rally in Kingston on September 28th. So please, everyone, definitely check that out. If you're in another country, hold a sister demonstration. But quickly, Scott, I know you have to go soon. Do you have enough time for a quick question and a response?
Sure.
Okay, so Dennis Speed, I know you have a question. Please go ahead and we'll try to make this quick.
Yeah, right, Scott. I wanted to make sure that you could have the opportunity to address one thing. With respect to the events of last week, one of the things that is coming out in the press, which I would like you to address, is that ostensibly there are people at the Pentagon that thought twice about giving these powers to the British and intervene. But I'd like you to address so that people are clear and that there's no, shall we say, temporizing with what you've already presented today, what the actual reality is with respect to the American administration and what people have to realize they have to do in contrast to, shall we say, waiting to see if somebody else does the right thing.
Yeah, well, let's look at it. On September 6th, Lloyd Austin, who's the Secretary of Defense, was in Ramstein, Germany for, I think, the 24th iteration of the Ukraine Contact Group. This is where the United States and its NATO allies, European supporters, meet with Ukrainians to discuss Ukrainian military priorities and how they're going to be met with, through the infusion of weapons and money, et cetera. And Zelensky attended this and made a very forceful pitch for the United States to sign off. And Zelensky was hopeful that Lloyd Austin would give his permission. Indeed, much of the press coverage was that this was the place where Great Britain and the United States were going to sign. But as you've said, Dennis, the Pentagon it understands war. Say what, you know, I know we don't like the military industrial complex. We have little respect for, you know, a $1 trillion budget and all this kind of stuff. But the professionals in the Pentagon, and there are some, understand war and understand the realities of war, and they understand where the Russians are coming from. And so Lloyd Austin was not willing to sign off on that. And he said, there's no single weapon that's going to solve this thing. This is going to have to be negotiated. That was not the message Zelensky wanted, who immediately picked up his phone and called the British, who called Tony Blinken. And Tony Blinken and his British, the foreign, secretary counterpart, Mr. Lammy, I believe his name is, or flew into, or not flew in, took a train into Kiev, where they met with Zelensky. And again, the expectation was Blinken was going to make the big announcement. But the Pentagon, again, intervened and said, no, there are consequences to this. So Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, began a PR campaign. First thing we saw is, I think it was 15 former British officials and generals came out and said, the Russians are bluffing. This is a big bluff. Don't be scared of the bluff. The Ukrainians did that. And Starmer flew to the White House, where he was told by the National Security Council, Biden was ready to sign off, that Biden agreed, shared, that this was all a bluff. So I think the big point here is that we're not out of the woods, because we had the Pentagon, who are the warfighting guys, say there will be consequences, dire consequences, that of giving a green light to the Ukrainians to use this. The State Department chose to override the Pentagon. The Pentagon was able to stop it. A foreign government sought to override it, almost succeeded. And it wasn't the Pentagon that stopped it this time. It was the Russians that stopped it.
Right.
But what happens when in these discussions they say the Russians are just bluffing? Oh, you Pentagon guys are just too scared. You're too nervous, nervous nillies. The Russians aren't going to use nuclear weapons. I mean, you see this all the time. I see this everywhere. The Russians would never use nuclear weapons. Well, even Anatoly Antonov said a nuclear war must never be fought, can never be fought. But there is a Russian nuclear doctrine. And the doctrine is very specific about that which would trigger a Russian nuclear response. And one of it is a conventional strike by NATO, which represented an existential survival question for Russia. And again, the scenario that I laid out, where Ukraine is used as a proxy to initiate a sequence of events, the Russians view this with such concern, because again, remember, I mean, everybody here is familiar with Ray McGovern, a brilliant former CIA analyst. Ray has been saying this for some time now, that the Russians, the red line that Russia made with Biden even before the special military operation began, going back to December, was you can't put missiles in Ukraine. And Biden said, oh, well, we're not going to do that. But then Biden backed off, because the strategy of the United States and NATO has always been to put these missiles in Ukraine. Why? To launch the very kind of sequenced preemptive assault that I just described to you. Because the commander of Strategic Forces of the United States said that his favorite course of action with the Russians is preemptive nuclear strike. This isn't a joke. The Russians read this. They hear this. They know this. This is the danger we face. Russia's always said this is a red line. There's some in the Pentagon that are respecting this. What we need to do is help amplify this, but now we come to one of the fundamental problems. The FBI knocked on my door on August 2nd, 7th. They came in and seized my electronics right here in this wonderful little studio I call my workspace. Why? Because they're trying to make the case that I was an agent of the Russian government. Not the spy versus spy kind of agent, you know, spying, because I'm not in the government anymore. I can't spy. No, I'm an agent of disinformation. I'm somebody there who's trying to undermine the election by spreading and propagating Russian disinformation. And I believe the FBI, who may or may not be watching this this panel today, either directly or indirectly, because they've been in my house, so I assume that they're monitoring everything I say. And the FBI might say, well, what I'm doing right now is simply just Russian propaganda, Russian disinformation. This is the problem we face, because in trying to oppose bad policy, which is the duty and responsibility of every American citizen, I don't know why the FBI thinks that it's unpatriotic to try and disrupt an election. The mere fact that I pick one candidate or the other is disruptive, because I'm saying I support this over this. But we are in a situation now where the U.S. court system, backed by the Department of Justice, has promulgated an official definition of what they call disinformation. Disinformation isn't about the facts. Disinformation is that which deviates from the official narrative. And so now we have people like Hillary Clinton who are trying to criminalize people who are engaged in disinformation. That means that the mere fact that we speak out and challenge official policy somehow puts us at odds with the powers that be. So we're fighting a two-front war here. We're fighting a war where we have to explain to an American audience the importance of standing up to bad policy, and we have to fight a government that says that very act of explaining is criminal. And it's they're making it very difficult. We cannot let up. This is the existential issue of our time. You know, there was a time back in 1775 where an American patriot on Bunker Hill, I believe, or maybe in Concord or Lexington, if they want to fight, let it begin here. Let it begin here. You know, I just need to remind the audience again The Constitution begins with the words, we the people. We the people. We're the only things that count. The government doesn't count. The government exists for us. The government is supposed to be responsive to us. The mechanisms used to control the government are set forth in the Constitution of the United States of America. And the First Amendment is the most empowering mechanism there is, free speech and a free press. If we yield on this, if we allow the Department of Justice, the FBI, the Biden administration to define what a free press is, to define what free speech is, to limit free speech, then I guess we deserve the fate we're going to get. And in this case, the fate will be the inevitability of a nuclear war, because the Biden administration, without any checks and balances, will take us straight down that path. We have to fight bad policy, but we have to fight in defense of our rights. And the defense of free speech and the defense of a free press right now are existential in nature. We cannot yield on this. We must continue to stand up and fight. I don't know how many people have been intimidated, and I have to say, myself included, by the new laws that were passed, or the new legislation that was passed, or the new sanctions that were set forth by the Department of Treasury, backed by various U.S. codes. But one of the things that they put in there is that they've sanctioned a wide range of Russian media outlets, and they've labeled them foreign missions. And there's a specific legal reason why they did that. But now what they've said is that anybody who engages with these sanctioned foreign missions and provides a goods or service, anything of value, is breaking the law. My lawyer, other lawyers have looked at this and said, an interview with one of these sanctioned entities fits the definition of a good or service, not because money is exchanged, but because it becomes a thing of value for the sanctioned entity. And so they are literally breaking the law. They're literally violating the Constitution. Again, 18 U.S. Code Section 241 makes it a crime for any one person to conspire with one or more persons to violate the constitutional rights of an American, to take action to do that. The Department of Justice is literally in violation of U.S. law, because by sanctioning, because the take action, and one of the things they say is through fear and intimidation, to impede the constitutional rights of an American. Well, what is the threat of imprisonment? What is the threat of having the FBI come to your door? What is the threat of bankrupting you by making you go through a legal process that could take months, if not years? That's fear and intimidation. And the U.S. government is in violation of its own laws. I will tell you this. I mean, I don't want to predict the future and everything like that. I'm a man of limited means financially, and I'm just one person. I'm not going to let them get away with this. If they want a war, let it begin now. Let it begin here. We are at war. It's a legal war. It's a constitutional struggle, but we are at war. We have domestic enemies in the United States. I'm someone who took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And there are domestic enemies today, and I can name them: the Department of Justice, the National Security Division of the FBI, the Biden administration itself. They're at war with the Constitution. They're at war with the American people. I'm not talking about violence. Please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I would never support violence. What I am supporting is the rule of law. I am supporting defense of the Constitution. The U.S. government has given us a mechanism to fight back. We have a court system. It's time to take the U.S. government to task. And we need to counterattack. We don't need to sit here and let them come at us. We need to come at them, preempt their assault on the Constitution. So anybody who feels that they have been threatened by the U.S. government, intimidated by this sanctioning to in a way that limits your free speech, limits your ability to speak to whom you want to, limits your ability to engage in the exercise of a free press, you might want to consider maybe making common cause with people and finding a way to make we the people a weapon against the tyranny that the Biden administration and their agencies in the U.S. government are trying to impose on us.
Thank you very much for that answer, Scott.
Yes, thank you. And Dennis Small, do you have a response before we continue?
Well, we have very important discussion to follow, so I'll just very briefly underscore two or three points from what Scott just said, which I thought were particularly significant, and to have the dialogue on this. As you and many on this show realize, the LaRouche movement has a lot of experience with this. In fact, it was about 35 years ago that they railroaded Lyndon LaRouche and a number of others of us to jail by that same apparatus which you just described, the corrupt government within the permanent bureaucracy in the Department of Justice, the FBI, and so on. And this is the same ongoing battle. You said we're not out of the woods yet. Emphatically the case. And people should remember what Scott said on that. It's good to breathe a sigh of relief over those 72 hours, which didn't happen, but we are far from out of the woods. And that's because the underlying cause has not actually been reversed on this. And they are going to keep coming back at it until an entirely new system is put in place. Besides the comments from Putin, from Antonov, from Peskov, Ryabkov, and others that you mentioned, the comments of Volodin are particularly interesting, because in comments a few days ago, he said that besides the repeating what Putin had said on the danger of nuclear war, he said, listen, Putin is trying to avoid a war. He is trying to avoid having this thing go to a nuclear escalation. That was a very important formulation. I happen to believe that it's true. How to do that is a very tricky question under these conditions when they're trying to corner you. The other thing that Volodin is known for, and this is from like a year ago or more, May of 23, Dennis Speed reminded me of this last night, and so I went and looked it up. Volodin, at the time, talked about the underlying problem. He said, look, what's going on here is that there is a debt bubble which is totally out of control. He said, quote, the U.S. public debt is a global financial pyramid built by Washington to defraud other nations. History has shown that all pyramid schemes eventually fail. So the usefulness of that is that it points in the direction of where not just the pause button, which may have been hit for a brief period of time, but the actual solution to the crisis actually occurs. And one final point, your opening comment that, listen, this is the overriding issue for every person on the planet. Absolutely the case. And I'd like to just remind people, Helga Zeplerush does this frequently. I was rereading the speech given by then Prime Minister Nehru of India at the 1955 Bandung Conference. And he said, we're non-aligned, but that does not mean we don't care. We will be affected and destroyed by nuclear war just like anybody else. And I say this in particular to our friends in the South, in the nations of countries that feel like they're just watching a ping pong match and they feel they can have no impact on what's going on. That's not true. You can and you must. This matter is as urgent for the smallest of countries in the most remote place as it is for Moscow, London, and Washington. And I want to urge you as well to take action, to be involved, to do what you can. And as Anastasia said, just one example, parallel meetings, demonstrations, and so on, and continue to expand this meeting. I think that goes hand in hand with the kind of mobilization that Scott was just calling for.
Thank you, Dennis. And I'll include in the chat on the Zoom meeting the link where people can go to see the demonstration, the information for that. Please attend it. Create sister demonstrations. We have people on from all over the world. We have 700 people on roughly live at this moment. We often get many more after the fact, but this is very important. So the more mobilization and action that you take right now, the better. And as Scott had said, you may not be alive tomorrow to take that action. So please mobilize as much as possible, that as humanly possible, and maybe even more than that. So again, thank you, Scott Ritter, for joining us. This was a fantastic discussion and a terrifying presentation, but I think it's important for people to hear it and for people to take action because of it. So thank you again for everything that you're doing.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we shall continue with our our agenda. That was really wonderful to get this out. We'll definitely split this up into smaller chunks for people to use for their organizing. But it is my joy to bring on Jonathan Kutab, who is the co-founder of Nonviolence International and executive director of the Friends of Sabeel North America. We just came off of a pretty fantastic conference in Dearborn, Michigan, of the Arab Conference, which had many Arabs from all over the country coming into one place. And the dialogue was very important, I thought. But we thought it would be important to bring Jonathan Kutab on to discuss a number of things today. So thank you so much, Mr. Kutab, for joining us. Please go ahead.
Thank you. It's indeed sobering after the presentation that we have heard. It's particularly sobering not only because the state of Israel has nuclear weapons and has expressed its willingness to use them under the Samson Doctrine, that if things got really, really bad, they don't mind bringing the whole building on top of themselves and their enemies, but also because there is so little attention that is being given to how the rules of international law are being totally disregarded, and a justification is being built in for such disregard of international law. Now, I'm an international lawyer, but beyond that, I am a believer that there should be restrictions on the power of states to just do whatever they want or whatever is in their interest or whatever they feel that they are entitled to do, even when they are involved in very serious existential war with their enemies. There have to be rules. There have to be restrictions. We have 194 countries in the world. You can't just have any country feel like it can do whatever it wants whenever it wants. Now, it's true that the international a legal system does not have sufficient methods to enforce international law, largely because the United Nations Security Council, which is charged with the power to rein in rogue states or rogue individuals, to impose sanctions, to have unifying for peace resolutions. Unfortunately, the United States, as well as Britain, maintain veto power and has rendered a lot of the provisions of international law ineffective and meaningless when it comes to Israel and the situation in the Middle East. But this is not the only instance in which Israel is flaunting international law openly and introducing its own doctrines in its place. One of these doctrines is the so-called Dahiya doctrine. Dahiya means neighborhood, and it's a reference to the southern neighborhood of Beirut, which is a largely Shiite neighborhood, which is viewed as being supportive of Hezbollah. Now, during the Lebanon War, the previous Lebanon War, Israel announced the Dahiya Doctrine, namely that the entire neighborhood where Hezbollah has people and supporters and institutions.
Mr. Kutab, you've been muted.
Is a legitimate target, and that they reserve the right to go in and utterly destroy al-Dahiyeh, that anybody in that area is a legitimate target because they are friendly to, or because they have organizations that are associated with, or because they are political supporters of Hezbollah, their enemy, and they are at war with Hezbollah, and therefore anything and everything that's related to Hezbollah can be destroyed. This totally undermines the distinction between combatants and non-combatants, between civilians and the military. It simply says, whenever I am at war, I can destroy anybody who is even related to my enemy. This has actually been used and is being used daily in Gaza, where Hamas is declared to be this evil force, and anybody that can be claimed or accused of being in any way associated with Hamas is legitimate, and we can go in with our superior military destructive power and destroy buildings, organizations, mosques, churches, universities, hospitals, whole neighborhoods, because they can be claimed to be somehow associated with Hamas, who is our sworn enemy. Now, I know that compared to entirely destroying the world, this may be a small point, but it is not. The idea that there needs to be rules and regulations, there needs to be laws, that even in war, even when you start a war, whether it's defensive or offensive, and Israel always claims that its wars are preemptive, defensive, so that even when they start a war, it's supposed to be defensive. But even in a defensive war, there are rules and regulations. When somebody surrenders and lifts the white flag, you cannot shoot them. You cannot kill them. When somebody is captured as a enemy combatant, you cannot torture them, you cannot rape them, you cannot deny them food and medicine and regulation. When you are capturing an area that is occupied, you cannot move your civilians into that area and set up settlements, and you cannot use collective punishment, and you cannot erase the distinction between a combatant and a non-combatant. You must accept the rules of international law. That's the minimum that is required. So I hope that one of the messages that should come out strongly, regardless of where you stand politically on the Israeli-Palestinian issue or any other issues, is that international law needs to be respected. The rules of war needs to be respected. International humanitarian law needs to be respected. Of course, we all want peace. We all want an end to violence and suffering. And of course, nations have their responsibilities and duties to protect their citizens, etc. But we need to have rules. We need to have international law. Would that we work more on peace and conflict resolution than we see these days. But at a minimum, we should oppose clear and blatant violations of international law. Certainly when it comes to committing genocide or having a system of apartheid or having a system that is racist and discriminatory, that should be stopped. We should not allow any state to act with impunity towards others, and anything we can do to strengthen international law and international institutions should be done. That's the 10 minutes that I have. I know there's a lot more that needs to be said. The horrors of what is happening now, continuing horrors in Gaza, in the West Bank, and now moving into Lebanon. It seems to be that there is no end to this craziness and to this madness. Sometimes I don't know what there is left to say anymore. The very fabric of international law and international legality and international morality is being systematically torn to shreds, and people seem to be okay with that.
No, I think that's true. And I really appreciate the work that you've done, Mr. Kutab, with your organization, and the work you've done with Reverend Isaac in recruiting Christian Zionists. I think this has been incredibly important. And some people don't even believe that it's even possible. And I think it would be okay if you wanted to speak a little bit to that before we continue.
Okay. Christian Zionism is one of these really nefarious doctrines that are fueling the fighting and the repression that is taking place. And Christian Zionism is an example of how religion is often used, sometimes cynically, to perpetuate evil and violence. Because I'm a Christian, and because I'm very familiar with evangelicals, having grown up in a Christian home, I know that many people who are evangelicals accept Christian Zionism not out of a commitment to its doctrines, but out of a failure to read and understand their own scriptures correctly. Just like people abuse Islam when they go in for ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other really false interpretations of Islam, also there is false interpretation of Christianity in the case of Christian Zionism. And I have to say that this is where dialogue and education becomes very important. It is not always necessary to fight and kill your enemies. Sometimes you can just sit and talk to people and discuss it with them, show empathy, show understanding, try and understand people in their own terms, and maybe avoid resort to violence. Even in national disputes, violence and war should be the very last thing on your mind. Because even when you're successful in war, you create so much suffering, so much hatred, and so much problems down the line. So whenever it is possible to engage with others, to show a level of empathy and understanding, to try and resolve disputes non-violently, even to struggle non-violently for your goals, that should definitely be something that is encouraged. And that is one of the things that we do continuously in our organization, FOSNA, Friends of Sabeel North America. It's a Palestinian liberation theology movement that believes that theology should be a positive, not a negative force, and for the liberation of people, and not for their oppression, and not for their used to justify racism, and even, in our case, genocide.
No, exactly. I think that's very important, especially, I mean, people are suffering through something this atrocious as a genocide. It's very difficult, I think, for people to see that path, but it's very important to stick to that in order to keep, you know, this strong moral arc of justice, you could call it. I think that's very, very important. So thank you for that, Mr. Khattab. And thank you again for all the work that you're doing. And we will have more during the discussion period. I want to ask Mosi Raz, who is a former member of the Knesset and former Director General of Peace Now, if you could speak, please go ahead.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Yeah. Oh, sorry. I want to thank Mr. Khattab for his things. First, I want to say about the nuclear issue, especially because I'm not an expert for that. The first man in the world who used a nuclear power is a criminal, or the criminal of this century, be it Russian, an American, Israeli, Ukraine, Iranian, or whoever does it. No question about that. And there is no matter, no reason for that. It's not interesting what happens before. Second, I want to say for Mr. Khattab, I appreciate what you're doing, and I will call you my friend. I hope we will be friends. I think it should happen. I agree with 90% with what you have said, but I feel you spoke about the North. You did not mention the South. Or if you want the opposite, you spoke about the South. You did not mention the North. Yes, in a war, first, we have to do whatever we can in order to prevent war and in order to bring an end to this war. Second, occupation is unacceptable, even if it is maybe legal. This is now in the court. Of course, for a short time, it's legal. But it is still unacceptable. And the things you mentioned about Israel, I might agree with many of them, but you didn't mention the other side. You didn't mention that in October 7, Hamas attacked Israel, killed civilians, Jewish civilians, Muslim civilians, citizens of Israel, Druze citizens of Israel, Christian citizens of Israel, citizens of American citizens, British citizens, Russian citizens, Ukraine citizens, German citizens, South Americans, East Asia, Thai citizens, and so on and so on. They raped women and men. Not all of them, but many of them. We know about many cases of rape. They took as hostages hundreds of citizens, not all of them Israelis. They took Jews and Christians and Muslims to captivity. They took to captivity a child 9 months old. They took to captivity men 85 years old, and many others between those ages. And they launched a missile attack on Israel, using missiles targeting civilians in Israel or in Palestine or in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Is a war crime. I agree with that, but in both sides. And the terror organization of Hezbollah from Lebanon, the day after, launched missiles to Israel. And yes, Israel responded. And yes, both sides are making crimes, and both sides are using violence. So when we talk about that, we have to mention, I'm not saying that there is a symmetry. There is no symmetry between a strong state who terror organizations. I'm not saying that there is a symmetry, there is not, but I think it's not, it's just not the all part of the truth, talking only about crimes of one side without mentioning the other crimes. Now, I want to bring an end to these crimes. I want to bring an end to this war. I think that the Israeli occupation in 67, in the lands that were were occupied in 67, should come to an end. I am a big supporter of peace between Israel and Palestine and all the Arab nations, with an independent Palestinian state in the 67 borders, or something that might be changes that might be agreed between two sides. And I am willing to hear about any other solution that bring justice, security, and civil rights to all the people who live in Israel and Palestine, be Muslim, Jews, Christians, Druze, Palestinians, Israelis, everybody, the same rights, the same obligations. So I'm willing to hear about any other. I still support two-state solution is the best, but I'm willing to hear about any other solution that secure the rights of the people, secure the rights to live. I'm pretty open to hear about that, and I think we have to work together, Palestinians, Israelis, Arab, from other nations, and all the world, all the international community, to reach that day, hopefully soon.
Thank you, Mr. Yeah. Mazi Raz, for that. I think what we're going to do is we're going to go to one more response, and then we'll come back and have a discussion here, because I think this would be important to pick up, to have that. okay, so sorry, I had an adjustment to the agenda. So next I'd like to go to Fernando Garzon, who's the executive director of the Ecuadorian Palestinian Union and a university professor and a UN consultant. So please go ahead, Fernando. And I'll remind everyone in the audience, please make sure that you have your translation on. Check on the bottom. He will be speaking in Spanish. Make sure you have your translation on.
Es posible que no lo haga porque me pongo muy... Yeah. Buenos días.
Good
Buenas
morning,
tardes. Buenas
or afternoon, evening, everyone here present. I would, first of all, like to thank the IPC for this invitation and opportunity to share relevant aspects of our situation. I have pointed out the need to interpret things in a historical context regarding what is happening in Gaza and related to Hiroshima. Why? Because they share particularly concerning aspects about history itself. The Lancet magazine, which offers a very serious scientific analysis of the number of people affected by the Israeli intervention on Palestinian territory. And they estimate, as of last July, that there might have been as many as 186,000 fatalities That is a large percentage of the population, even compared to populations in Europe. And there is also a very interesting point that needs to be clarified, which is keeping in mind the first application of atomic weapons in Hiroshima can also apply in the Gaza case without a... which is equivalent to a A-bomb in terms of the number of casualties. Also, a large percentage of the highways and roadways in Gaza have been destroyed, which eliminates the means of the population to survive. And these are data coming from the UN satellite database. These are not loose interpretations or our own data. There are also there is also information that the impact that these military interventions have had have led to the destruction of all Gazan structures. 156,000 structures are estimated to have been destroyed, as well as 215,000 homes, which is over 60% of all Gazan structures that have been either destroyed or severely damaged. These are catastrophic results of this impact due to the explosions of bombs and missiles in Gaza. There's another specific issue regarding crops, which is also comes from United Nations satellite data, which states that 75% of Gazan agricultural fields have been destroyed, have become unusable. That is, the possibility of life has been destroyed, the ability of survivors to continue existing and find a way out of their own territory, which is a territory in which all three monotheistic religions in the world have converged in this territory. This is where this is happening. It is very striking, therefore, how important it is to have a better integrated historical perspective as well as a human perspective. And this also applies to Europe. In Guernica, at the beginning of World War II, and now we speak increasingly of a third world war, what happened as a result of military action carried out by the Nazi Air Force and immortalized in Picasso's famous painting, a catastrophic result also took place. 250 kilogram bombs were dropped, which destroyed 70% of the buildings of the town of Guernica at that time, which gives us an idea of how the numbers may seem demonic when there are very similar historical results. And when I mention Hiroshima in relation to Gaza, the data bears this out. In Hiroshima, the bomb that was dropped was the equivalent of 7,000 tons of TNT. These were uranium bombs. When we speak of 16,000 tons, it killed 70,000 people instantaneously, apart from all the people who died later. Why do I bring this up? Because I'm trying to say, is this mere genocide or something beyond genocide? Because it is very concerning, because we're being led to consider this as a natural part of a conflict to destroy an entire population, and we are being accustomed. This is being normalized for a future of nuclear confrontation, such as could happen in Europe. If we extend this concept to Europe, up to 10% of the population could fall in the early attacks. This How many people, how many structures would be destroyed? How does this compare to Gaza? This is why we say that genocide, as established in the United Nations Convention, which has been adopted by the entire world, leads to a concept which I call terracide, or not just of ethnic groups, but entire populations, territories, and everything in that territory. This is clearly a crime, that it is total and integral destruction. Hiroshima was a test of what humanity, unfortunately, seems to be heading into. This is why it is necessary to speak of peace as a countervailing measure to the increasing talk of war. And in this sense, I would like to highlight the clamor for peace coming from different countries around the world, here from Ecuador, and to bring up the important proposal of linking peace to development, peace with security, peace with technological progress, peace with development, a peace which is not merely an emotional call, but the concept of a plan, of a plan itself, means that there has to be a historical plan, both in the short, medium, and long term. This is a solution that has been often stated here in the coalition with the Oasis past plan, but also elsewhere in the world, when we refer to the issue in Ukraine. We speak of fighting for a peace proposal based on planning, based on dialogue, based on a coalition of hope, and finally, something which will open the road to peace for the entire future of humanity. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor, for that presentation. We have one final thing, which we did have a team of people on the ground at the UN who were speaking with diplomats, organizing people going into the UN before this vote happened just a few days ago, or just the other day. If we have Jose Vega on, there we go, who's in New York City. He's running as a candidate in the Bronx. Please go ahead. And we have a video as well from on the ground.
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, hi. Yes, I'm an independent candidate running here in the Bronx in the 15th Congressional District. And a lot of you may know my opponent, who his name is Richie Torres. And he is not only an apologist for the war crimes and the crimes against humanity that are happening in the Middle East, but he is an advocate for it, and proudly so, and very snide about it. There is what we were doing at the United Nations the last few days, myself and Morgan here. This was about, we were there yesterday, a day after the United Nations had just voted overwhelmingly to declare the occupation of Israel, and it's illegal. Excuse me, that what the Israelis are doing in occupying the land of Palestine is illegal, and that it needs to end, and that they stripped Israel of its so-called right to self-defense. And so that was the basis at which we were at the United Nations. Of course, there's also going to be a lot of activity, a lot of world leaders coming into the United Nations starting next week. We were there because my campaign has endorsed UN Resolution 377. Which would allow the General Assembly to act as if it were the Security Council in the event that the Security Council fails to prevent catastrophe or fails to act in a timely manner to prevent atrocities such as what we are seeing in Gaza and Palestine. And so I believe that is an ongoing process and dialogue that's being deliberated right now at the United Nations. And so I know we have a video, and I do want to say a little bit more after we play the video, but I do just want to, and what you'll see in the video is one experience we had, but there were also some positive experiences that we had. And I want to talk a little bit about that as well, because what we were doing was we were passing out as well a statement and a testimony from this doctor named Dr. Mark Perlmutter, who went to Gaza for 3 weeks. And there he described just the most absolute horrible conditions. And just so you get a little bit of background on who this man was, he is a disaster war zone doctor. He has been a ground zero after 9/11. He was there after Hurricane Katrina. He was there after the earthquakes in Haiti on the ground, you know, committing to an emergency mobilization to make sure that people don't die. And he's been in a lot of other disaster war zones. And he has said none of those experiences amounted to what he saw at in Gaza. And the things he had to do just to, you know, make sure that some of these children who he were treating would continue to live or go through the surgeries pain-free because they didn't have anesthesia. And he didn't go into specifics as to what he had to do. So think about that. You don't have anesthesia, and 90% of your patients are children, most of which might end up dead days or hours after getting treated. This was the reality. And he was in touch with the Israeli embassy every day, letting them know what was going on. And sometimes they would respond and sometimes they didn't. Okay, so the American government is very well aware of who this man is. And when he came back in April of this year, he sent a letter to Biden. He sent a letter to the senators. He sent a letter to the Congress. He also sent a letter to the UK upper and lower chambers of parliament. He sent a testimony to the Bundestag in Germany. And because of his testimony and 99 other aid workers and doctors, the UK has halted arms sales to Israel, at least until the ICJ comes back. But he has not heard a word from any officials in the United States. He has not heard a word from Biden. He has not heard a word from any elected official or non-elected official, whether it's in the U.S. government or in the collective Biden administration. So we were at the United Nations. And before we play the video, do you want to talk a little bit about the positive experiences that we got?
Do that after.
Okay. Or yeah, sure. Okay. All right. Makes sense? So if we can play that video. Today at the United Nations, I was handing out a leaflet with the testimony of Dr. Mark Perlmutter, a doctor from Rocky Mount, North Carolina, who went to Gaza for 3 weeks. This man was at ground zero on 9/11. This man was there when the earthquakes in Haiti had happened and after Hurricane Katrina and a lot of other disaster zones. And he would tell you firsthand that those experiences don't amount to anything that he had experienced in Gaza in those 3 weeks. This man feared for his life the entire time he was there, while also treating children who would possibly be dead in the very next hours or days after getting treatment. 90% of his patients were all children. And so we went to the United Nations today to give out a leaflet with a QR code that contained a link to his video. We were standing in front of the delegate entrance of the United Nations trying to get the testimony into the hands of the UN delegates. And what happened was the security officers at the gate were grabbing the leaflets from the delegates' hands and confiscating them and keeping them.
And don't let security confiscate you.
There you go. There you go. Wow.
But they did it again.
Yep.
And so what we decided to do was we decided to go up and ask the security, hey, why are you taking our leaflets? To which they told us that they were instructed to do so by their superiors and their higher ups. And when I asked, is it the paper? Is it the text on the paper? Or is it what is said on the paper? They said very clearly to me, no comment. What is it about the testimony of Dr. Mark Perlmutter that they do not want circulating in the United Nations while they are deliberating on policy right now? The day after the United Nations voted to strip Israel of its right to self-defense and asking it to leave the occupied territories and asking it to stop its illegal war and genocide on the people of Palestine. What are they afraid of? Why hasn't this testimony of Dr. Mark Perlmutter been circulated in the United Nations by the American side? This is a Jewish American doctor whose only time off he spent in Gaza to tell you, the American people, the German people, the British people, the people supplying the bombs to Israel,
what your country is doing and what your tax dollars are doing. Why do they not want that truth out there? So do your patriotic duty and share his testimony, share his videos, and share his stories, because he went over there to tell the truth about what's happening. And it's your job to make sure that truth gets spread.
All right. So I, first of all, just want to, before I ask Morgan to say a little bit more on some of the positive experiences, you know, we are trying our best here in the Bronx to create conditions of peace and unity. On September 11th, we were invited by a synagogue, the Friends of Jose Vega Chorus, and I was part of this chorus as well, sang. We were invited by a synagogue to go, and, you know, it was part of their ceremony to commemorate the lives lost on 9/11. And it shows that there are conditions at which everyone can get together and, you know, realize that tragedy must be stopped. And we are doing a lot here. We tried to, we did a big push here in the Bronx to commemorate Sholem Aleichem as well. And we're doing everything we can here to try and increase the dialogue for peace and unity. Do you want to say a little more?
Yes. Hi, thank you for the panelists and the people watching. I would encourage everyone to watch the video again. We see one of the diplomats actually argue back and forth with the security. She takes a picture of it, and then she asks for his badge because she knew what he was doing was not right. Some of the diplomats actually, they thanked us. One of them was saying that they unequivocally knew what was going on was a genocide. One of them had stated, you know, God bless you for doing this and God be with the people of Palestine. We saw just an overwhelming positive response from the diplomats to hear this man's testimony, because it is exceptionally powerful when you hear the words, what he went through and what he witnessed himself. In his testimony, he speaks of two children that he got in one day. They were both shot in the head and in the chest. One, the father actually witnessed it. He was holding his child's hand, and it actually, the shot rang out, and he had no idea what had happened. And then the child was blown away 10 yards, and he ran up to his child, and his child received a second shot to the head. These statements are very powerful, and they move people, and I think it needs to get out.
So, yeah, I think that's where, I mean, and also, I mean, I don't know if Mosey is still on, but I did want to ask him, you know, if he had any advice for us here in the Bronx. I know it's a very contentious period right now, but I just wanted to, you know, to have people's consciences be raised for peace. You know, we can denounce the violence, but we have to replace it with peace. So that's where I'll end it.
Unfortunately, Mazi did have to jump off, but I think Mr. Kutab could also respond to you as well, if you'd like.
Yeah, I'm sorry Mr. Mazi has left, because I wanted to respond to what he had said first. Because I really did...
Yeah, you can also respond to him, and we can make sure he gives this response.
And in a way, he spoke about what happened on October 7th in total isolation from everything that happened before, on that day, and after that day. He also repeated the thing about supposed rapes, which have been debunked and shown not to be true, the beheaded babies and the rapes. But my point was not even to discuss what happened on October 7 or what happened with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict generally. My point was the need to follow law, international law, that even when you do have a war, even when you do fight, even when there is reason to fight, that it has to be done in a proper way under the rules of law. And of course, it means you have to avoid civilian targeting civilians or taking civilians as hostages, regardless of which side it's on. A war crime is a war crime, and something that's prohibited is in fact prohibited. Now we are facing a different situation with the genocide as an ongoing thing that is happening in front of our eyes. We haven't had a genocide that was taking place in real time, which was being documented and filmed, sometimes by the Israeli soldiers themselves, even as they are doing it. We haven't had leaders who openly say, we want to destroy Gaza. We want to kill everybody. We want to destroy everything. We want to cut off their water, their food, their medical supplies. We haven't had that, I think, in modern history. And that calls for a response by other countries. It calls for a response by human beings as beings. It calls for a response by organizations and civil society that have to actually carry out sanctions against those who violate the law. Because if the United Nations doesn't itself do its job and bring an end to this, if the different governments in the world do not carry out their obligations under international law to ensure compliance, then it falls on ordinary citizens like us through boycotts, through divestment from corporations that support human rights violations, and through bringing sanctions against governments and against organizations and corporations that participate in violations of human rights. This is why BDS, boycotts, divestments, and sanctions, are really nonviolent methods of enforcing international law. And we should all be involved in BDS activity.
Thank you. So I don't know if, Jose, you had anything else before we move on to the discussion period.
No, I don't. I don't. I would just, you know, like to emphasize one more time, you know, I think people should get the resolution 377. I think it's something that most people should, it's a statement that most people should read and endorse. People should listen to Dr. Mark Perlmutter. And, you know, Mr. Kutab, I think, and to everyone here, you know, the nuclear war matter starts with the view that people have of individual activities. You know, I think what everybody does matters, no matter how small or big it is. And I think the point is people have to act. So that's all I'll say.
Let me say one thing here before it gets off, because I think the issue, that last thing that just got raised, is important. The point is this: the view of humanity. One of the things that you raised, Dr. Kutab, which caused me to think, I hadn't asked this question, but in the case of the Northern Ireland conflict, was there ever a case where the British tried to blow up an entire neighborhood in response to the activities of the IRA?
No. No, there have been occasionally a house that would be demolished, or a building as a punishment. And under international law, you cannot use that either. Collective punishment is not allowed. But no, the British did not use the Air Force against the IRA. They did not bomb entire neighborhoods. They did not try to force entire neighborhoods to vacate so that they could find the IRA and destroy everything. No, none of that.
Just wanted to corroborate that, because I remember having studied a bit of that back in the 70s when the troubles were going on. Some of us who were involved in high school debating teams and things like that had to take these matters up. And I remember that this issue of atrocities was one that was one of the major foci. This notion of killing people who have surrendered, torturing people after they have surrendered, or raising neighborhoods to the ground was one that was of some, you know, some focus at the time. And I did not remember ever encountering that. So I just wanted to ask you to make sure my memory was correct.
No, there wasn't. The problem, I think, and it's a very serious one, it's the problem of exceptionalism. When your country feels that it is to be exempt from the rules that apply to everybody else, whether it's American exceptionalism or Israeli exceptionalism or any country that feels that our country is special. It's different. It's unique. And the rules that apply to everybody else don't apply to us. You know, I do a lot of work with human rights. And as soon as any oppressor says, oh, you don't understand our situation, it's different, immediately that raises the red flag that we are unique, we are different. The rules that apply to everybody else don't apply to us. I think international law and human rights law and provisions should apply to everybody, friend and foe alike. When we say torture is wrong, meaning it's wrong, regardless of who is the victim and who is the perpetrator. If he's a bad guy or a nice guy, it doesn't matter. If he's our friend or our foe, it doesn't matter. That's the beauty of law, of international law, is its universality. It applies to everybody across the board. And again, I wish Raz was here again, because that's the one thing that I ask. I don't ask that you be pro-Palestinian, pro-Israeli, pro this, pro. I just accept the fact that law applies equally to everybody else. Something as basic as that. And then if he's not willing to accept that, then we have a problem.
Right. No, we'll definitely make sure this response gets to him and maybe have a dialogue with him separately with you. I think that would actually be very important to continue that discussion. We are going to move to the general discussion period. If you are on YouTube, there is a registration link in the description. Please select that. You have to be registered to be part of the online discussion if you'd like to discuss with the speakers that you see here right now. If you're on X or Facebook or anywhere else where this is being broadcast, please go to schillerinstitute.com. And the first item on the website is the registration form to get the link for this meeting to be part of the attendees. So with that, we will move on to our discussion period.